This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Dr. Andrea Miller, Associate Dean for Undergraduate Studies at LSU, and her book is Oil and Water, Media Lessons from Hurricane Katrina and the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. Also, we are slated to hear from Noel Hammett, the former East Baton Rouge Parish School Board member, commenting on yesterday's move in the Louisiana House as a panel approves the East Baton Rouge overhaul of the school system, giving principals broad new powers. And we'll talk with Porter Shreve with a book from LSU Press entitled The End of the Book. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Andrea Miller, Associate Dean for Undergraduate Studies and Administration at the Manship School of Mass Communication at LSU. And she has collaborated with two other authors on a major work involving the media and coverage of the two big disasters in Louisiana in the last 9 years, Oil and Water, Media Lessons from Hurricane Katrina and the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. Andrea's been at LSU for almost 12 years, so she weathered both incidents, as did most of us. And, of course, the media did some things that were very good and maybe some things that we're not so good, and that's why Andrea has written the book and why she's in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
The first one's 2005 and the next one's 2010. Two totally different types of disasters, but both right in our backyard. And for somebody like you who specializes in media coverage of tragedies, this is ripe for what you do.
That's right. The disasters are very different. Katrina happened in the middle of an American city, so the coverage was, in a sense, easy for journalists because it was right there for them to cover. Many of them experienced and lived that tragedy just like the audiences they were serving. They lost their homes also. They lost friends, and their futures, you know, were uncertain, and mm-hmm. they were dealing with insurance, just like, you know, all of the people that were watching their coverage. And then you skip ahead 5 years, and the oil spill is a very different disaster. It happened miles off the coast, so access was limited, unlike in Katrina. And they had to really rely on other people to get a lot of their coverage. So visuals were not ready available. The oil was gushing at the bottom of the ocean, and so you can't go there and cover that and see those effects. And so you have to wait and see what happens as far as those effects. So two very different tragedies for these journalists to try to tackle in this five-year period.
And we're talking national journalists and local.
Yes. And there's a huge difference between national and local news. I am an advocate for local news. I think it is so important to our democracy. But that level of importance goes, you know, raises even higher when you are faced with a crisis, because this is your community that you live in and that you are covering, and you're trying to get information that's going to be helpful to them to cope with and deal with it. And also to make good decisions about disaster. And so local coverage is very different. It is more personal. It is more connected. Well, as you know, national news tends to paint disasters and news coverage in, with a wider brush, if you will. And local news cannot do that. Is their responsibility when disaster strikes to give the people in their communities what they need, and sometimes what they need to survive and what they need to help and start that recovery when the tragedy is not ended, but ended to a point where national news has now left and gone away. the local journalists are here to stay, and they are the ones that are going to continue to bring those stories to the forefront to make sure that their community is resilient and recovers.
The book, Oil and Water, from Dr. Andrea Miller, Media Lessons from Hurricane Katrina and the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. Jay Darden, the Lieutenant Governor, says the authors have penned a thought-provoking commentary on contemporary journalism, its role in the evolving genre of disaster reporting. They were two different types of disasters, 5 years apart, and the media evolved quite a bit between 2005 and 2010. There were different types of media, different ways to present information. How did that change the landscape?
Well, if you'll recall, at the time of Katrina, Facebook was in its infancy. We didn't even have Twitter. And Instagram, all of those things weren't even available at that time. Carl Arredondo, who is a meteorologist down at WWL, in one of the interviews, he told me that the first time he ever texted was during Hurricane Katrina, because that was the only way that many people could communicate at that time because of that. And so Hurricane Katrina was, in a sense, a digital maturation of the market, because they had to use the internet to put out information, because they had such demand, not only locally, but, you know, internationally. Websites were crashing from these news stations because they had so much traffic, because where do we go when disaster strikes and it's not in our community and we're not part of it? We often go, again, you know, to local media. And so from Katrina, WWL's website, for example, and the Times-Picayune, which published online during that time period, you know, they were able to create community portals, if you will, where people could actually post and show damage in different areas, or ask questions about this person is missing, or what does my house look like at this address? And so the media was starting to be used now in a different way, online and digital, using those citizen journalists, if you will, in a way that hadn't been done before. And then you fast forward to the oil spill, and we have all of these things now, but we don't have access. Mm-hmm. We don't have access to the site. We cannot, besides that live camera, do you remember the live camera shot that BP gave us of the gusher? Besides that, we don't have access. And so until the oil starts to come on land and those kinds of things. And so very different, again, in the way that things were coverage.
Well, in one incident, the government was largely responsible. And in the latter, the company was responsible.
Yes.
So sometimes companies are better at covering things up than the government is.
That's right. So we have there's a chapter in the book that's really, the blame game. Who's running this disaster? And we look at the frames that the media use to present the coverage, and the attribution of responsibility, which is essentially the blame frame, is very often used. So in Katrina, it was the different levels of government. For the oil spill, you have to think back to that time period when big business was not a good thing to be a part of, because we were in the middle of that economic downturn. And we had BP, this big, huge international business, who did not do very well with their PR work, by the way. You know, we're talking journalism here, but there's a whole nother PR aspect of that. And they, received the blame for that
Well, and the media pounce upon sound bites, and certainly radio is always looking for sound bites. And I think of the BP disaster, and I think of Tony Hayward saying, I need to get my life back.
Yes, absolutely.
And in the Katrina disaster, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
That's right.
Those are the two quotes I remember most.
That's right. And we mentioned both of those are in the book, because they are, very important pieces. So people remember those kinds of sound bites. But it's also interesting to think about the visuals between these two. Because one of our first studies, we did 6 weeks after Katrina hit, and we asked a large group of students at LSU what their most memorable image of the disaster was. And what do you think they said? I'll ask you.
In which one?
For Katrina.
For Katrina, mm-hmm. The most memorable image?
The most memorable image. What's the first thing that comes to your mind when I say that?
I think of those people stranded on the roofs in New
Absolutely.
Orleans.
Absolutely. Yeah. You are exactly right. Mm-hmm. That was the number one image. And so I think at this point we can almost call it an iconic image. So 6 weeks after Katrina, that's what they said was the most memorable image. 4 years later, when we did the survey again, that is still remains the number one image. And so, that repetition of that image and how emotional it was really affected people.
Do you think the media did a better job covering one or the other?
I think, for Katrina, they won lots of awards and very well-deserved awards because of their coverage. And because of their access and because of their embeddedness, if you will, and their involvement, I believe their coverage for Katrina was stellar. They didn't do everything right. For the oil spill, because of all the different things they faced, so we talked about Haywood and Suttles, who's also a BP executive. Their sources essentially parachuted in, and so they had to have access to these sources that came from out of town, unlike Katrina, where, they had a beat. So they knew Mayor Nagin. They knew all of the players in Katrina and had access to them. They didn't have as much access because Suttles and Haywood, who are they going to interview? They don't know WWL. We all do, but they don't. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're going to go to the national news, who has now parachuted in to New Orleans to cover this story. And so the journalists that we interviewed felt a bit slighted because here they were, Pulitzer Prize winning journalists that did this wonderful job in Katrina, and they are being pushed out essentially of another disaster that is in their backyard and that they know they can cover and do a good job. And so, again, those dynamics are interesting.
And at times like these, radio stations become more important.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. So even nowadays when a disaster hits and we have all of these things like Twitter and Instagram and, all of that pales in comparison to the way that people use radio during disaster. When the power goes out, when they are traveling, for example, when they're evacuating, they're in their cars, they're on they're listening to radio, and it usurps, if you will, all this wonderful digital technology that we have. We go back to old school. We go back to radio because we know it's tried and true. It's going to be there. It's going to serve us.
All right. A question from Jonathan. Why hasn't General Honoré used his cachet from Katrina to run for public office?
Absolutely. I mean, he is an important figure, in Hurricane Katrina and continues to be an important figure when it comes to the coast and the environment. So far
he's stayed on the sidelines.
Yeah, yeah.
And the person most synonymous with the Deepwater Horizon spill, a public official, I think, was Billy Nungesser.
Yes.
And he ran and lost.
He ran and lost to, yes.
Jay Darden.
Yes, absolutely.
In a bitter campaign. And Jay Darden endorsed your book.
Yes, so. He's in there. He's mentioned a little, Billy Nungesser is in there because he was one of the sources that a lot of the national media went to.
Okay. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. We shall return after this 90-second pause. On 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing. 297-5633 is your number. In just a bit, we will hear from Noel Hammett, the former East Baton Rouge Parish School Board member, who has some thoughts about a bill that's moving its way through the legislature that may very well become the law of this great state of Louisiana, in which principals will have broad new powers in East Baton Rouge. But we continue with Andrea Miller, who's written a captivating book about Hurricane Katrina and the Deepwater Horizon spill, oil and water. And certainly it's captured on the cover. Catchy title and an important topic. 2005, 2010, if things go according to the calendar, maybe next year we'll have another one of these to deal with.
Let's hope not.
Let's hope not. But twice in 5 years, Louisiana, little Louisiana, with 4.5 million people in a country with over 300 million people, somehow we are often the focus of the nation and the world.
And the media coverage can often frame how people across the nation see the disasters. And so how the media frames things, I'll give you an example. During that Katrina time period, my office faced the PMAC at LSU, and so I could see the ambulances mm-hmm. coming and go and the helicopters and all that kind of thing. And I had people, friends of mine from across the nation, calling me, wondering what's going on, asking me all these questions. And the kinds of questions they were asking me made me realize they were watching different news coverage than I was. Okay. And so, again, it goes back to the differences between national and local. As you know, national tends to be a little more sensational. They operate in that conflict frame as well as that attribution of responsibility frame. And so the things that they were seeing nationally, the local news was now taking it to the realm of, okay, recovery. What can we do? In the scholarly area, we call it linkage and management, social management. So that's audiences that are listening know how to figure out where they need to go to make their next step. And so where do I go get water? Where can I go register for FEMA? So the local media helps you make those linkages to this important information. Well, the national news is not going to tell you where what FEMA office you can go to or what's set up or where you can, go plug in your phones or get laundry done, those kinds of things. But the local media does. It connects you with Red Cross. It connects you with that local help. And so, again, that local national, the differences in the coverage makes a difference in how they see events, because most of us do not experience crisis right here at home. We see crisis from afar. It happens in the other state. Mm-hmm. It happens overseas. And so we have to rely on the national media to give us an accurate representation of what's going on. But when it happens to us in our cities and in our states, it's a different level of responsibility for the local press to serve the people, the audiences.
You also focus in the book, Andrea, on the evacuation after mm-hmm. Katrina. And Baton Rouge, you write, got about two-thirds of the evacuees, at least the greater Baton Rouge area. How did the media cover this?
Well, first of all, you remember the wording that was used. So were they refugees or evacuees? Do you remember how that? And that, again, that was national and local. So local media were calling them evacuees while national press started calling them refugees. And we wanted to, we interviewed and surveyed people who had evacuated from Hurricane Katrina just to look at their media use. And so we talked about that earlier, how they started, when leading up to the crisis, everybody's watching TV. Everybody's watching, their local meteorologists. And then it switches over in that evacuation mode to the radio. They're listening to the radio. They're at, you know, at shelters and various points. They're getting in their cars and listening to New Orleans radio stations, even though they're in Baton Rouge, even though they're in Biloxi. Why? Because they're dependent on that local media. And so even though everybody was dispersed, you know, New Orleans press was still at the crux, still at the very center of their information.
And in the Deepwater Horizon crisis, you have an observation, media trips over science.
Yes. For that chapter, we interviewed 8 scientists because, again, that the national narrative on the oil spill was tricky. One day you're seeing a report saying dispersants are safe. The next day you're seeing a story saying they are not safe. And so we were getting these conflicting messages. So we went to the scientists and asked them, what do you think? What do you think of the news coverage? And they were highly critical of the scientific narrative, mostly on the national level. Now, they were somewhat critical of the local local level. But on the national level, you know, they were getting calls from, you know, people from all over the world wanting to, you know, when are we going to see this in our seafood? When are we going to see this and that and this? Is this going to be effective, the dispersants, that kind of thing? And they were saying it's so much more complex than just, you know, a soundbite, as you said earlier. You know, the soundbites often did not tell the full story. And one of the things that we suggest in the book is that we really do need specialty journalism, because journalists nowadays, often they're doing away with beats and different kinds of things. So people like Mark Schleifstein in New Orleans, Amy Wold here, you know, specialty journalism that look at environment or science or whatever it may be, whether it's business, you know, that's an important piece in order to ask the right questions. You have to ask the right questions and be able to put that information out there in a way that that all of us are going to understand and be able to use.
But more and more journalists are being counted on to cover diverse topics because there are fewer journalists. So what you're advocating may not be reality.
Exactly. Unfortunately, it may not be reality. But we are in a place where, as we've said, 2 major disasters that have environmental pieces to them have happened. And to me, that is, you know, it shows the importance of it, because it's going to happen again, unfortunately. And we need to have people in place, those boots on the ground that know what they're talking about, that know how to ask the right questions in order to help maybe alleviate some of the problems that may come out of these things.
Well, next time, if heaven forbid something like this happens again, when we're on the air, I want you to be in the studio critiquing. So that would be a good thing. From Andrea Miller, who has spent a dozen years at Louisiana State University, got her PhD from the University of Missouri. Michelle Miller, CBS News correspondent, says, Oil and Water takes a sharp look at disaster reporting and examines the multitude of local and national coverage following Hurricane Katrina and the Gulf oil spill. Lynn and Melrose. Lynn, you're on the air with Dr. Miller. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning, Anna and Jim. I haven't heard the whole broadcast, but I wonder if in your book you had noted the supreme irony that the Deepwater Horizon event is now the only source of money to help save the coast. So in a way, it was a disaster. In another way, it was a blessing in disguise.
You know, and I will say there is another piece of that as well, in that BP is funding a lot of research, a lot of scientific and social science research at LSU. And so it is very ironic that they are funding some of these studies that may show, you know, consequences and long-term effects, which we are still studying. And so I agree with you. There is definitely an ironic situation that, you know, they are funding a lot of these studies that we hope will help the coast.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andrea Miller is not resting on her laurels. You've got another book coming out soon, right?
Yes. We are looking at the future of the newspaper industry using the Times-Picayune and their frequency change going from 7 days to 3 days as a kind of a microcosm of the industry.
Well, so we look forward to visiting with you on that topic as well.
Oh, great. Thank
you. Another one that's right in our backyard. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
297-5633, your number, and we're joined by a gentleman who has graced our studio a few times in the last several years, Noel Hammett, former East Baton Rouge Parish School Board member. He served 16 years in that capacity. Lost to Barbara Freiberg.
That's correct.
And Noel continues to attend meetings and make his voice heard. And he speaks as somebody who I think knows the lay of the land as well or better than anybody else. But he is a passionate guy and occasionally has drawn fire from those who disagree with him. Yesterday, a hotly debated bill to redo the East Baton Rouge Parish school system by providing principals new powers moved within one hurdle of completion as the House Education Committee voted 10-6, 10 Republicans in favor, 6 Democrats opposed. Among the Republicans voting yes, Steve Carter. Among the Democrats voting no, John Bell Edwards. The proposal, Senate Bill 636, sponsored by Bodie White, faces action in the House and then would go to the desk of the governor. And it according to some, would be a sweeping change. Noel, what do you think of this?
Well, I think it's a tremendous change to the East Baton Rouge Parish school system. What it also does is it takes the voters of East Baton Rouge Parish within the confines of the East Baton Rouge Parish School Board area, and it has them voting on a different kind of school board than any other citizens in the state of Louisiana. This is a local bill. It applies to just one school system in the state. Although it's written as though it's for all large school districts, they carefully crafted it. It applies to one. And what it does is it says to citizens in East Baton Rouge Parish, and by the way, this bill was put together by the Chamber of Commerce, and they simply looked for members of the legislature to carry it. What the chamber is saying is we don't trust the citizens of East Baton Rouge Parish to elect a school board that will do what needs to be done. So what they have done is basically place the students in EBR in a kind of experiment to see how this works. They claim that they were informed about this procedure of giving autonomy to principals by leaders around the country. The fact is, no leaders around the country, no research institutes, including the one they claim is their research group, the Center on Reinventing Public Education, no one actually supports what the BRAC Chamber is doing here in Baton Rouge.
All right, 297-5633 is your number for Noel Hammett, who has taken the gloves off. I thought Noel might be in the middle on this, but he's obviously dead set against it. Among those testifying yesterday in favor of it, the East Baton Rouge Area Chamber, the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, Adam Knapp, of course, was instrumental in Noel's defeat a few years ago. East Baton Rouge Parish DA Hiller Moore, the Sheriff Sid Gautreau, Chandler Loop, they're all in favor of it, and you got people like Noel on the other side. I think, are reasonable people. They've obviously bought into this.
Oh, they absolutely are. And if you listen carefully to their testimony, what they say in their testimony is, we believe education is vital to working with crime, dealing with young children. They absolutely believe in that. They said nothing at all about the bill itself. I don't believe they really know much about the bill. I don't believe, for example, either one knows anything about the fact that it disenfranchises the voters of East Baton Rouge Parish. So when we vote for a school board member, we're no longer voting for a school board member that has the same rights and responsibilities as they do in 63 other school, 63 other parishes around the state. There were 50 names in support signing on to this, and I suspect if my local chamber comes to me, and I don't know much about the chamber, and they say, we've got a bill that's going to improve the schools, sure, I'm in favor. I think all of us are in favor of improving the schools. But in fact, it's been the chamber that has led, and the chamber has supported me at times in the past.
Not the last time.
But it's also the first time they went negative. And I remember calling Adam Knapp saying, you know, I don't mind you going after me, but why are you trying this scorched earth policy of bashing the school system? All of the teachers, administrators, and board deserve better of their local chamber. And his answer was, whatever it takes. And I think this bill is an example of that. This bill takes a kind of questionable policy that's out there that says you give all the responsibility for budgeting, for school buses, for maintenance to the local principals, and somehow that's going to improve the education of our students. Well, the group that Adam Knapp says supplied his information, the Center for Reinventing Public Education, if you look at all of their research, there's nothing that supports this autonomy. In fact, the one study they have by Dr. Steinberg at the Graduate School of Education in Pennsylvania said this: after looking at the city of Chicago and the autonomy they gave to principals, here's what his research found. Quote, I find that receipt of greater autonomy had no statistically significant impact on a school's average math or reading achievement after 2 years of autonomy.
Okay.
That's pretty clear.
5633, as mentioned, this was a vote along party lines, 10-6, and the Democratic caucus chair, John Bell Edwards, who is on the committee, voted no, and he says the bill as created is going to invite absolute chaos. Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on with Noel.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Noel.
Good morning.
When I think of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, and I'm African-American, and Mr. Noel, you know that the overwhelming majority of students in the East Baton Rouge Parish school system are African-American. I see nothing there that warrants any support for what they're trying to do other than for compromise with the folks down in St. George. And I'm ashamed of my DA, and I'm ashamed of my sheriff, and I will never support them again. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, I think the chamber's doing some very good work on economic development. But some would say that's what a chamber is for, not to get into issues like this. Noel is nodding. You obviously
can't catch my nod on the radio, of course. But the chamber has not. The last good thing the chamber did in education was a set of papers. They called them the White Papers on Education. And if they just went back and read those papers now and then, I think it would change a lot of what they say. We hear a lot of claims, and the chamber leads the bandwagon when it comes to claiming EBR is a failure. Yet the East Baton Rouge Parish school system, with 83% of its students on free and reduced lunch, happens to be a high C-rated school district, and is almost a B.
297-5633. We'll return with Noel Hammett and go to the phone line, starting with Albert in North Baton Rouge after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633, your local number, 877-217-5757 outside the area. Yesterday, the House Education Committee passed a bill that's already cleared the Senate. It's one step away from reaching the governor's desk. Presumably, Governor Jindal would sign off on this. And it overhauls the East Baton Rouge Parish school system, providing principals new powers. What kind of new powers are we talking about, Noel?
Well, principals would have the ultimate responsibility for everything that takes place within their schools, which is to say they have to provide for transportation, food services. They have to take care of getting textbooks. They have to choose textbooks. Everything that happens on that school campus, according to this bill, is under the authority of the school board, under the authority of the principal. Currently, those are shared duties, and all of the major groups basically support the idea that these are shared responsibilities. The RAND Corporation, certainly not a teacher's group or a union supporter or principal supporter, says in their largest study looking at autonomy that three key issues districts should consider in making the decisions are principal capacity, district efficiency, and principal expertise. None of these are included in this bill. It simply passes those powers on and basically would destroy much of the magnet system we know today.
All right, 297-5633 for Noel Hammett, former East Baton Rouge Parish School Board member who remains active. Last time he was on this show, he switched his party affiliation from Republican to Democrat. Albert in North Baton Rouge, good morning, Albert. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jim. And I want to salute Noel Hammett, you know, that you continue to fight the good fight for our children in East Baton Rouge Parish.
Thank you, Albert.
I just want to make a couple of quick points about this whole thing. This bill undermines the whole premise of democratic governance of our schools. If you think about it, why would you need a school board that has no power? That's basically what we're going to have with this bill. It gives principals powers that they do not need, that they have not asked for, and they have made clear that they actually do not want, and yet the legislature seems to be willing to do that. And then finally, this bill is facially unconstitutional. And haven't we had enough of passing bills that we have been warned ahead of time were unconstitutional and wasting of the taxpayers' dollars on lawsuits? So those are my comments. Don't take my comments off the air.
Well, he's absolutely right across the board. It is an unconstitutional act in a number of ways. But again, this legislature in the past has not been, especially under Steve Carter's leadership and Appel in the Senate, has not been afraid to put bills out there that everyone tells them are unconstitutional. And it means that a certain attorney has made a lot of money fighting these. He's lost each of the battles, but
who would that be?
We'll fight this one.
Governor's attorney?
The governor's former attorney, sure.
Faircloth?
Faircloth. Okay. Jimmy Faircloth has fought most of these battles and lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another issue. Should lawyers get paid on a contingency basis, winning or losing cases?
I think it depends on the type of lawsuit they're fighting.
Well,
but these lawsuits...
Our friend, your neighbor, Steve Myers, just spent a couple hundred grand or thereabouts on a case, and he got one vote at the Supreme Court level. I would imagine he would be in favor of a contingency payment.
In this case, we often want to look after the fact. But the fact is, across the board, legal experts who have testified have made clear what the legal problems with these bills are. And we do not find the legislature, it seems as though they don't care, in part because they don't have to pay the bills. Maybe what we should do is just as we have fiscal notes on bills, maybe we ought to have legal notes. But the bottom line is this bill is on its face illegal. And it is part of a larger project of privatizing public education. And, I end a lot of comments with follow the money. And in this case, you mentioned the chambers about economic development, and it is. And it's mm-hmm. focused on businesses. And lots of businesses are making lots of money in Baton Rouge right now off of charters and off of the kind of destruction that comes from this bill. This is a bill that destroys the democracy in East Baton Rouge Parish when it comes to an elected school board, because you're electing a school board that has absolutely no power. Now, the chamber hasn't been satisfied even with the board members, apparently, that it's bought and supported.
Now, so, wait a minute. Bought and supported? That's pretty
sure.
strong, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is, because people. It's the first time in the history of the Chamber of Commerce, and you can go back through the records, Jim. It's the first time the chamber went all out to defeat board members and
but
to
you
use
were okay
a smart
when they were
policy.
Supporting you, weren't you?
Yeah, we received 5,000, I think, or maybe 2,000 in my largest campaign contribution from the chamber. But they never went out and attacked the other guys.
They didn't buy
they
you
didn't
for 2,000? They didn't buy you for 2,000?
Nobody's buying me at any amount of money. But the bottom line is, when you run a campaign based on attacking anyone who challenges you and you bash the school system, so... We've heard claims across this town that 40% of our students are in failing schools. That actual number is 5.1% and dropping drastically. The majority of students in failing schools in Baton Rouge right now happen to be in charter schools.
All right. Well, a few more minutes with Noel, and then we'll get to an interesting gentleman, Porter Shreve, the author of The End of the Book. This vote was along party lines yesterday. Chandler Loop, who represents District 3 in the Metro Council, says he receives 200 to 300 emails a day on education. This is in today's story in the Baton Rouge Advocate. And he says many of his constituents believe the school board is not supporting them. He thinks this bill might be a corrective measure.
Well, Mr. Chandler also stood there and said that all of the members of his district are opposed to the East Baton Rouge Parish School Board, and we heard one after another standing up saying they aren't. And in fact, the leaders of many of the groups, Together Baton Rouge and One Community, One School District, live in his district and are not in favor of the kind of changes that he's proposing. I believe he will be heavily supported by the chamber in his next race.
Pat at LSU. Pat, good morning. You're on with Noel Hammett.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, if the principals are given the power to decide everything for the school, could they just subcontract it back to the school board office?
That's certainly one of the possibilities. They could do that. There's no requirement to do that. One of the problems is some of the things that would not be turned back over to the school district, for example, disciplining of students. There are state laws that govern how that can be done. What you're now doing is placing a principal in a position. A principal is not the head of a legal government entity. If you had a problem with your local school, you can't sue the school. You can only sue the school system. So we have a situation where principals could go out and take action, sign contracts, take action against students that are illegal. There's no redress to the principal or the school. The redress goes back to the school system itself, which under this law can't enforce any of the contracts, can't have oversight. So you have an elected school board that has no power but ultimately is responsible for your tax dollars. Pretty problematic.
Well, Noel, you speak now as a Democrat, and
I speak as a citizen.
Well, but as
a
citizen who's a registered Democrat, is there any coincidence that this vote went along party lines?
I don't know that it did. I don't know that that's a coincidence. I know that power is shared differently. I know that the chamber impacts groups differently. They're more likely to support Republicans. But I think in this case, it's a matter of misinformation. I think some of it's pressure from the chamber. I find it interesting that not a single school board member spoke yesterday. Barbara Freiberg was there but did not speak.
Did the superintendent speak?
I do not know if the superintendent spoke.
Okay.
I don't think he did yesterday. He did speak before.
Well, SB 636, sponsored by Bodie White, who's been a busy bee in this session, would give school board or school principals new authority by allowing them to craft budgets, hire and fire personnel, and oversee instruction and curriculum. So it's a strong bill, but some have noted that the bill is aimed specifically at East Baton Rouge and could be unconstitutional because it applies to only one school system.
Among other things, that's correct.
Well, okay. Well, we will follow it, but my guess is it'll pass.
I think there's a good chance. There's a lot of power behind it, a lot of money behind it.
Well, and I must commend you, Noel, because you come on this show, whether you win or lose, and you always stand tall and hold your ground, and there are people who disagree with you passionately, but you just keep coming back for more. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We're joined now by Porter Shreve, the author of three previous novels, The Obituary Writer, Drives Like a Dream, and When the White House Was Ours. And his latest work for this man, whose work has appeared in Salon, the Chicago Tribune, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, and Washington Post, is The End of the Book, a novel from LSU Press. Good morning, Porter Shreve.
Hi, Jim. Nice to be talking to you.
Nice to talk with you. The End of the Book, that's certainly a compelling title. Tell us about this novel that has received to this point very nice plaudits from those who have reviewed it.
Yeah, I've been happy with the reviews. The end of the book is a story It goes back and forth between two different time periods, present-day Chicago and Chicago at the turn of the century. In the present day, it's the story of an aspiring novelist who may or may not be writing a sequel to Sherwood Anderson's classic novel, Winesburg, Ohio, which was a big influence on Faulkner and Hemingway and various other writers. At the same time, he's working for a huge internet company on a big project to digitize the world's books. But he hates his job, and he wants more than anything to be a writer at a time when, you know, with the end of the book, being a writer is very challenging, and book culture has never been more threatened. In the backstory, counterpointing that story, is the story of George Willard, who's the protagonist of Winesburg, Ohio. So in some ways, the backstory is a sequel to Winesburg, Ohio, and George Willard arrives in Chicago at a time in the turn of the century when it was the fastest-growing city in the history of the world. And so we follow his story in Chicago, and it's sort of counterpointed with Adam's story in Chicago, and there are a lot of echoes between the two stories, and they eventually intersect as they both struggle through through various crises.
Willard marries his wealthy boss's daughter.
Yeah.
That's always a prescription for disaster.
Right. It seems good at the time. But, you know, if you're writing a novel, you got to, all hell must break loose. And so I had fun making that happen. One fun thing for me to do was George Willard ends up working in advertising around 1908 and 1909. I had not watched Mad Men at the time that I was writing this book. But it was fascinating now to have caught up on all of Mad Men and to see the origins of Mad Men and what I researched, because Chicago was the hub of American advertising 100 years ago. And I was researching these advertising firms that were really the seminal advertising agencies, and I had George working in one of these agencies. And so his boss would have been like, you know, the big kahuna in Mad Men at the time. And that relationship, of course, sours because George is a restless soul.
Well, he is an adventurous sort. As you say, shows up in a city that was the fastest growing in the world at this particular time. George Willard is a character that you inherited, right?
Yeah, you know, I was teaching in the Midwest for about 10 years. My mother's from the Midwest. I'm very familiar with Middle America, and I've lived there for about 15 years. I just moved to San Francisco, but I spent so much time there. And a real emblematic story in the Midwest, particularly at the turn of the century, was somebody from a small town striking out for the big city. And if you're standing at the train station in Winesburg, Ohio, and catching a train, it's probably going to be going west to Chicago. And that story of what happens to the small-town kid in the big city is endlessly fascinating to me and a renewable resource. So I just thought, what would happen when George arrives in Chicago? And I just wanted to write that story.
Well, this time, a century ago, was even though Chicago was a bustling city, it was much different than what we know of contemporary America. How was it for a kid from nowhere coming to the big city at that time?
Well, he just initially was completely overwhelmed. It was a dangerous city, full of vice. If you've read Devil in the White City, and I know a lot of people have, the vestiges of that Chicago, which would have been 1893, were very much still alive. Really dangerous, wild, corrupt. I mean, in some ways, you know, the origins of Chicago are still with that city. But absolutely bustling. And he, at every moment in that story, he's in danger of being swallowed whole by it. But in some ways, he's rescued by the boss's daughter. But he doesn't necessarily like the cloister that he finds himself in, and so keeps entering new dangerous territory as the novel goes forward.
The end of the book, a story from Porter Shreve about George Willard, and it captures this time and place majestically. In one of the chapters, you describe the coffee houses of that time, certainly a little different than those of today.
Yeah, it was so fun to do that research. And I thank goodness for the Internet. I mean, you can pull up menus now. Thousands of menus from 1907 know exactly what people were drinking and eating. And, you know, I miss libraries, and I love to be in libraries, and I went to many of them. But it's nice to access them in the way that we can now.
Well, a well-received novel from LSU Press, The End of the Book, from Porter Shreve, a New York Times notable book author. We thank you for joining us today, and congratulations, Porter.
Thanks, Jim.
We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.